The speaker is Stefan from EPFL, and we will talk about his works on action and collective effects. And thanks for accepting to give the talk with such a short notice, and you can start.
Okay. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk. I'm going to talk about axions at high densities, and what I mean by that is how the axion, some properties of axions get modified in high density environments, and by high I mean nuclear saturation density, so how axions get modified in supernova or neutron stars. This is work in progress together with all these people down here. So we all used to be in Munich together where I did my PhD, and the work is still continuing. And I'm going to split my talk in two parts. The first one will be on the QCD axion and the couplings of the QCD axion to nucleons and how they change at finite density. And the second part is more on ALPS in general and how ALPS can change the structure of dense stars like neutron stars or also white dwarfs. So let me jump in the first part directly. So let's first motivate in a couple of slides the QCD axion. The QCD axion is a solution to the strong CP problem. The strong CP problem is related to this theta term of QCD, and this term gives rise to neutron electrodipole moments, and we've measured them. We've not seen any neutron electrodipole moments, which constrains this theta bar parameter to be extremely small. And the QCD axion is the solution to, or a solution to that. And in essence, this parameter theta bar is promoted to a dynamical field. And QCD itself generates a potential for this field dynamically, non-perturbatively, and this relaxes this parameter to zero. Exactly. And so what I'm going to look at are the properties of this field, the QCD axion. And again, as an introduction, so generically this field couples to photons as well, to FF dual. And just for the ones who are not very familiar with it, so there is a big open parameter space. So in this axis, there's the axion mass. This axis is the coupling of the axion to photons. And the generic prediction is that the mass and the couplings are related. So this is this line or band. And there's an order one factor that depends on the actual UV model. That's why it's not an exact line, but a band with a. And you see up here all kind of different experimental or cosmological bounds in the QCD axion. On this coupling, and in the future these will be getting much, much stronger, so there's a huge activity on how we can constrain this parameter space.
So you're saying that in the foreseeable future, the QCD axion will be...
Most of it will be tested. It's not clear how foreseeable, so these are some of them are more longer time.
But, sorry, in this...
Some of them assume that the QCD axion is dark matter.
Exactly.
So it's not all of them are on the same footing. By far not. It's just to give you an idea. So what I will be looking at in this talk is a different parameter space. It's the coupling to nucleons. So here is the coupling to neutrons. So some of the best bounds on the QCD axion at the moment come from neutron star cooling and supernova cooling, from the supernova 1987. So from the neutrino signal that we've seen. And if you look back on the plot before, you see that these are a bit better, but probably similar in this range here on the axion mass. And I'm going to investigate these bounds in some more detail, so we'll come back to those. One thing that I'm going to ask is, where do the predictions for the lines here in this parameter space actually come from? For this nucleon for the coupling to neutrons and protons. And we'll see that these couplings get modified by order one factors. And we'll explore the consequences of that.
Derivative coupling.
This is the derivative coupling.
Okay.
Yes. So just to flash the results, so for the chaos we set axion, the derivative coupling to the neutron, this is the prefactor of it. It's of course suppressed by 1 over Fa. For the neutron, it's at zero density compatible with zero with an error bar sitting at about 0.02. And what we've found is that at finite density, this changes by order 1. The error bar, because of the carrier perturbation theory expansion, I'll show everything later in detail, is getting bigger and bigger as you go to higher densities. And what we'll try to understand in the first part of this talk is exactly the consequence, like how this arises and the consequences of that.
So here, like a number density of a neutron equals number density of the proton itself.
Here, number density of neutrons and protons is set to the same value.
What happens if you only have neutrons, for example?
We also have, I can show you the results. It's similar, but it's like slightly different, but similar qualitatively. So just to start with, in the UV, above the QCD scale, below electric symmetry breaking, the axion couples to GG dual. The axion has, of course, its kinetic term. And there is a model-dependent coupling to the quark currents. And for simplicity in the talk, I will not include these. I will set them to zero, which corresponds to the KSV set axion. In the paper that will appear soon, we're, of course, keeping them as well. But it's much easier to explain it like that. So then below the QCD scale, the theory is a theory of pions, the QCD axion, and non-relativistic baryons. And then at energies even below the pion mass, one can integrate out the pions, and one arrives at the theory of only non-relativistic baryons and the axion. What I will be focusing in this talk is mostly this theory, because we'll see that in the environments that we are discussing at the end, the pions are actually playing an important role. But I'll start briefly with this theory, because that might be more well-known. So this theory was, among others, constructed in this paper, the QCD axion precisely, where the pions were integrated out. So one starts just with the Lagrangian of non-relativistic nucleons coupling to the axion derivatively. So it has two terms. One is proportional to GA, which is the axial nucleon coupling, and one is this G0, which is the isoscalar coupling. Both of these couplings, so this is known from nuclear beta decay. This can be determined on the lattice, and the structure of these leading order interactions is completely determined by symmetries. And one finds that the axion couple is to the proton with, this is again this dimensionless coefficient with some order 1 strength, but to the neutron, this coupling is rather small. And the smallness is not something that is structurally small. It's just a cancellation of two a priori completely unrelated things that depend on the quark masses and these constants. So that was part of what got us interested in, is this coupling really small? And
I got distracted. So you have GA and G0.
Mm-hmm. And the C up minus down and C up plus down depends on the quark masses in the KSVZ axion model only.
And the C, then you went from G to C.
The CN, so this depends. So the nucleons are doublet. There's a tau matrix and the identity matrix. And then you have, for the proton and the neutron, you have the CN depending on the proton and neutron. That's all.
You have an accidental
cancellation here, and if you go back to the parameter space that I showed at the very beginning, this accidental cancellation is why people are shading all this region here and think the KSVZ axion is compatible with almost no coupling in the neutron case. Because, as we've seen, if one plugs in the numbers with error estimates, you find something that is compatible with zero and is very small.
Is it a cancellation?
Huh? It's a cancellation of it's a cancellation that depends on the quark, on the ratio of the quark masses. And it is a cancellation between the size of the GA and G0 and I think G0 and the ratio of the quark masses is everything that tells you the constellation. So the first question that we ask is, are these really the couplings that we should use in dense environments?
Sorry, so these numbers are coming from?
From plugging in the GA that we have measured in nuclear beta decays, the G0 we've determined on the lattice, and the quark masses we've determined on the lattice, and plugging in the lattice results plus error bars, error estimates from the lattice.
I may want to ask you, because this is something that I wanted to ask you about EDMs. Totally unrelated question. Okay? The strange quark in all these things does not matter.
Oh, it matters a little. So here I'm assuming just two flavor. If one includes the third flavor, it gives a very small correction.
A certain amount of strange.
Yes, but a very small amount.
But
it's not enough to undo the cancellation. It gives an order percentage contribution, I think, as well. With an order one error bar as well, so it doesn't really help.
Even that you have a cancellation.
Exactly, it could, but it does not, yes.
I think what's done, you take G2O, you chirally radiate it away, so there is a...
Exactly, it's
a quark pseudoscalar density singlet part of it, proportional to the...
Is the same thing in the Venetian?
Yes.
Of course, it's nothing more than
that. It's nothing more than that, exactly.
But then there will be derivatives of axion field times the effectively axial vector current.
That is what is done here to get there.
These coefficients are going to be mu divided by mu plus md.
Exactly.
Another one is md divided by mu plus md. And g0 is three times smaller than g sub 8. And so.
And then there's a cancellation.
Yeah, the cancellation.
Exactly. It's nothing more than that, I think. Yes. So the first question is, can we use these couplings in the environments we are interested in? So here we assume that the energy is much below the pion mass. If one goes to nuclear saturation density, or even higher densities neutron stars, and we assume for simplicity it's a free Fermi gas, at zero temperature we find Fermi momenta of already around 300 MeV. And if one adds temperature, it's even more. So it seems very suggestive that one should also include the pions in these couplings. So that's what we then did. We constructed the EFT not only of the axion and non-artistic nucleons, but also mesons, so the pions. Again, the structure is completely fixed by symmetry, as before. It is a Kuban expansion in momentum over nucleon mass, so that's the non-relativistic nucleon expansion. It's the usual curve perturbation theory momentum over 4 pi f pi of the pions. And then there is a momentum over lambda, where this lambda is the scale of contact terms of nucleons that arise. So this lambda is determined by integrating out resonances. And so there is a particularly low-lying resonance, which is this delta, which is only about 300 MeV above the nucleon above the neutron and proton mass. And this enhances some contact terms. And because of the isospin structure, one can even estimate which contact terms are larger. And of course, one has to be careful if one goes to energies where this could go on shell, then our theory definitely breaks down. But even before, our theory is, of course, on the borderline of being a good effective theory.
What order in B?
That's the next thing. Exactly. So the leading order coupling that we've seen before at p to the 0 would be exactly the same. So one just finds the same structure. And then what we are going to is the p squared. All of these terms are suppressed by 4 pi f pi squared. At p cubed, the first term that are enhanced by this low-lying delta resonance come in. And at p cubed, we are only taking these terms that we know have a large coefficient because of this resonance. We're taking them, but we are not including all of the p cubed terms.
So when you take p squared, you have to include the quark masses as well, right? Because the counting, chiral counting.
Yes, it's also m pi. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely. So then I'll just show the results. If one.
The pions are near threshold now that they are. P is the order of the mass of the pion.
That's exactly what you see here.
In an abstract world where P would be much bigger than mass.
Of course, if there would be a big separation, we would have a nice effective theory, but we don't have a big separation between the scales, sadly. So what you see here now is the, so we calculate all up to P to the third power, as just described. And one can split the result into form factors that depend on s dot pa, where pa is the axial momentum, and s dot p, where p is the outgoing nuclear momentum. And I'm showing here only these a form factors. And so that at zero energy is, again, just the standard thing we've seen before, because at zero energy, of course, both theories should give us the equivalent thing. And then as you increase energy, the couplings change with energy. And you see very clearly here the pion production threshold, where there is an imaginary part showing up. So the dashed line is the imaginary part in both cases, also here. And the error bar, we split in two cases. One is the uncertainty of the constants that we took from the lattice or from different M cases. And the second error bar that becomes large at high energies, which is an error bar that we estimated because we had to truncate our expansion at this order. So we estimated the size of the next order by multiplying our order times p over 4 pi f pi result, because the next order is not expected to have 2 times delta enhanced, only 1 time suppressed by the small scale. And yeah, so the results are the couplings change with energy. They change by order 1, not so much if you are below the pion production threshold. Above the pion production threshold, they get imaginary and change by a lot.
So this is the real imaginary part of what? Of the trailing?
Of that.
Sorry. And the imaginary part has to do with some absorbative part, sorry.
The imaginary part has to do with the fact that the pion goes on shell there, yeah, can be produced.
Okay.
How much does the pion mass itself shift?
Sorry?
How much does the pion mass itself shift in the nuclear matter?
How much does the, yes. So here, this is without any nuclear matter, it's only energy.
Okay.
We'll come to the nuclear matter part, and there, of course, yes, as you, you're very right, the pion mass also shifts.
Sorry, and that omega is the omega is the energy, the axion line. So what is the, I'm confused.
So
now, sorry, I'm confused.
So omega here is, let me see. So we have momentum P plus PA, PA of the outgoing axion, and P of the nucleon. And the omega is the P zero.
It's the energy of the outgoing.
Exactly, a nucleon. Okay.
P zero minus M.
Yeah,
of course, sorry, yes.
Sure.
You're, of course. Okay. So then this was, so far, nothing with density and only really the momentum dependence of the coupling. And now I would come to the density part. At finite density, the coupling is a bit modified. Not the coupling, sorry, the counting is modified, and I'll see in a second why. So one example of an operator that comes at higher order is this one, which has n bar n, and then on top of the normal axial nucleon coupling. And n bar n in a non-relativistic background of nucleons is just the number density. So it's basically scattering the axion of the normal nucleons with two background nucleons on top. And this gives a contribution. If one just plugs in the number density in terms of the Fermi momentum, that scales roughly like that. And if you compare to before, everything was down by energy over 4 pi f pi, or energy over lambda. In the density background, it's kf that comes in the numerator. So we basically...
You're saying that this effective operator is controlled by this lambda scale, that is the distance from the next resonance.
So this one, luckily not. I'm just showing this one here because it's very instructive and easy to see how this gives a density contribution. The ones that are...
But you're saying that this term...
This term here is down by a scale lambda that is closer to the rho mass and not to its low-lying resonance. The ones that are large and only down by this because of this low-lying resonance are terms that involve pions as well as axions, because the resonance has isospin 3/2, and then you need one pion from the nucleon to get to this resonance.
Anyway, naively, I would have put all these scales together, m rho and proton, unless you're doing some large n or stuff like that. But your differentiation is okay.
The differentiation is, I mean, again, if there would be a big scale separation, I think one should do all scales together. But we are playing here with a small scale separation, and if something is 300 MeV or 600 MeV, it makes a big difference here. So factors of 2 in the separation of scale make a big difference, even if then naively you will put all scales at the same level. So more formally, how we calculate this is we find our finite density and finite temperature propagator. We go for now to the limit where there's small temperature or zero temperature, and then the propagator is just the standard non-relativistic propagator. And there's this additional term, which is basically describing the filled Fermi C. So it's just integrating till the Fermi momentum if you integrate over a loop of it. And loops with this, so this double line notation is the notation for this filled Fermi C insertion, give us the density contribution compared to the loop where it's just 1 over k0, which is the standard loops that we've seen before. So with that, we are in the position to evaluate the same diagrams as before, just with in a background density. So the systematic expansion of before in momenta over 4 pi f pi goes to Fermi momenta. The diagrams that we are taking with us are the same as before, now with these density insertions of the modified propagator. And these vertices here, Ricardo, are the ones that are enhanced because they appear because of this low-lying resonance, because they need a pion. And that's why we are taking these ones as well. If one does everything and calculates all these diagrams and sums up, one finds the things that I've shown at the very beginning. So again, this A now is the same part of the form, the same form factor as before. You can see here now the dashed line is the vacuum contribution if we set the momentum to the Fermi momentum. So at these densities, it doesn't change much, the vacuum contribution that we've calculated before. The density loops, however, because they are not energy over 4 pi f pi, but kf over 4 pi f pi, already give quite big changes to these couplings. However, as said before, there is an uncertainty that comes from the uncertainty in the constants, but there's the big uncertainty because we are truncating our theory, and the expansion is not very good, and we estimate it, and it gives a large uncertainty. So if you just calculate and take them at face value, these form factors compared to in vacuum, so at nuclear density compared to in vacuum, you find order one changes. Here, a bigger change because it was accidentally small before, and now this accidental cancellation gets lifted. However, estimating the next order in carrier perturbation theory gives a large error that makes this still compatible with zero. Nevertheless, we would expect any coupling to follow one trajectory through here at finite density. So as you turn up density, it will not stay at zero forever. It will follow one trajectory with different terms scaling different with density. So we would not expect that this coupling can be zero everywhere for all densities. So now let's turn to the implications of that.
So I'm going to ask two questions. First, neutron star has isospin breaking. Do you have a multiple isospin breaking case?
I can show it to you afterwards, not in the slides. But
the other one is just conceptually, how does this compare with the ones where you have two pion exchange?
I'll come to that in a second.
Okay.
That will be one of the next things that I'll come to. Okay, so now I want to discuss some of the implications of that, and I'll start with the supernova bound. So what people typically take, or many people take, is you take this one pion exchange diagram of nucleons, put the axion there with the normal vacuum couplings, even not momentum dependent, and add some additional phenomenological suppression factors on top of that.
What do you mean by phenomenological?
I'll come to that also. So one of them is they estimate the two pion exchange diagram, sometimes estimating it as an effective rho exchange. All of that, of course, if you want to describe just the in vacuum interaction of the nucleons, matches well the scattering data that we've seen. However, at finite density, we think that a full calculation within carrier perturbation theory should probably describe the real physics better. So what we think one should do would be, so this is just a subset of diagrams, but calculate all kind of diagrams that are possible up to a given order. And so these phenomenological suppression factors, so people take this two pion exchange and give it add a suppression factor because that two pion exchange makes the nuclear force smaller. However, this would also change with density, and one should account for that. So that's something we want to do in the future, but we haven't fully studied yet. The other thing is that so the nucleon propagator gets some effective density dependent mass that acts like an IR cutoff, so it's not 1 over omega anymore, but it's 1 over omega and plus a mass. And also for that, people have added some phenomenological suppression factors, but within our theory, all of that would be calculable with error bars. So one of the things that we want to do next would be to actually do a full systematic calculation. Also for the neutrino emission,
The neutrino pair production, right? This is where the axial couplings come into play.
Exactly.
I've looked at this since the 80s. Right?
Yes. So people have looked at it. People have not done a full carrier perturbation theory calculation where one has an error bar, we think. Of course, people have studied it a lot. But what we want to do is a systematic treatment where we have an estimate of the error. And yes.
But if you calculate neutrino emission, you have to take account muons as well for a neutron star.
Yes, depending on which environment you want to look at the neutrinos, you need to take into account many more processes and not just that process.
Yeah.
But also that is something we are involved, doing it right now with Andrea Caputo as well.
How much neutron emission can be used to calibrate to check the calculation, if that's what you're after by calculating neutrino emission.
It's
not clear how much neutrino emission can be used to check your calculation, right? I guess this is the goal that you're trying. That's why you're talking about neutrino emission.
So what we... So So far we thought we'd do it for axions, but then we thought, why shouldn't we do first it for a standard model? We have neutrino emissions, and neutrino fraction rates are used in supernova codes, are used to study lots of that, and just to put some kind of theory error estimate on all of these things that are used for that. Not really for what we are doing now, it was just more a side comment that...
So, Stefan, I have started a very stupid question. Why is it that your propagator for the neutron does not have a momentum dependence? Just 1 over omega plus A epsilon.
There is next order corrections, which are P squared over 2M.
On shell, omega and K squared are comparable, sorry. The scaling, so omega is omega. Mm-hmm. Sorry, yeah, I'm confused. Don't you have omega minus K squared over 2M?
There's a K squared over 2M as a next order term. That is.
What you say is next order? Because time scales like x squared, right? In non-relativistic theories. You're measuring the
power. It emits a relativistic particle. A has omega equals to k, and so that might.
You're saying that the presence of A
changes the counting. Yes.
Sorry, you're right. So.
Thank you. Yes.
Because what matters is the k of A, is omega of omega over the k of A.
Exactly. That is what matters. Yes.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you. And what we are doing for now as a very first step is we are not adding the suppression factors that people have done here. We are just adding our density-dependent coupling on top of the von Paaren exchange. So this is a very naive picture, and the error bar that we are putting in there is really just from that and not the general error bar that one should estimate. So what follows is to be taken with a big grain of salt. But if one just naively adds these two diagrams instead of the von Paaren exchange only.
Yeah, so we have a question from Zoom.
Yes.
Yes, Anjay, you can talk.
Hi, I just have a quick question about your treatment of the nuclear-nuclear interaction. Von Paaren exchange is a poor representation of the nuclear-nuclear interaction. In chiral EFT, you're going to have lots of contacts, right. And those contacts describe short-distance forces, and they dominate the scattering, right? So when you're setting this up, what is the justification for doing Von Paaren exchange?
Oh, what the justification for doing that is, I'm not so sure. What we are doing now is we are taking at least the leading order contact terms with us. So I think we are taking part of it with us. Of course, as I said, a full calculation should take into account all diagrams that are possible up to a given order. But that is that we have not yet done, but we will do in the future.
But some of this has already been done in the literature. The axial response of nuclear matter, you know, using chiral perturbation theory and also using soft radiation theory theorems has been done.
Yes, I'm not sure which work you're referring to, but at least to my knowledge, a full calculation within chiral perturbation theory, including all effects to a given order, has not been done.
Sure. I mean, a very rigorous EFT calculation is yet to be done. Agreed. But many of the effects that are beyond what you're describing here has already been accounted for.
No, that I agree with. Many effects have been accounted for, but what we want to achieve is a rigorous...
means that you add everything.
We add everything and
so
we have...
added everything.
And we want to have an error estimate of what we are missing.
Okay, I see that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So yeah, as I said, this is to be taken with a big grain of salt because this is not taking everything into account and just the effect that we found and we think has not been taken into account before. And it changes the luminosity by a factor of order 10. So it will strengthen the supernova bound on the axion mass by an order of u. So square root of 10.
So sorry, can you give an estimate? So if I understand correctly, you have neglected the double pion exchange, mm-hmm. and you have tried to. You've put instead a contact interaction that.
So this contact interaction is the leading order contact interaction and the leading order Curry Lagrangian. There are, of course, at higher orders again coming contact interactions that we have not taken into account.
Higher order means there's a contact interaction with more derivatives, you're saying. Even the contact interaction comes with no derivative to derivative for derivatives.
Yes.
And you took into account just.
You took into account just the leading order contact. Yes.
Then he was saying that you haven't taken into account double pion exchange.
Yes, we have not.
Now, what can you estimate the effect?
Yes, so this is what has been done when people were taking this into account. And it seems like they give a factor of a few reduction. I'm not an expert and I want to calculate it now.
A factor of a few reduction in the sense that
that what people do, to my knowledge, is they add some kind of fudge factor that comes up for this reduction that is.
I don't understand. With respect to the single pion, more pions, you're saying they reduce by multiplicative factor of a few.
It seems that at these momenta, the total rate is reduced by a factor of 2 to 3, I think, if I.
By taking into account higher orders.
By taking into account higher orders. And these we are not taking into account now. For now, we could do the same as what they are doing, just adding this factor. But we want to do it in the future to do the full calculation of that.
So, but doesn't this mean that perturbation theory is totally out of control? If exchanging another quantum changes the result by a factor of 2 or 3, because I thought you still had a density that is small enough that you can do some. That the energy of the quanta is small enough that you can have some space for perturbation theory. But if that is the case, isn't this troublesome?
It is troublesome. I definitely agree on that statement. I am no expert on that part. What I know is that it still converges. So if you go to N3LO, it seems to fit at moderate energies. It seems to fit the nucleon scattering data reasonably well. And
I could imagine that if for some reason, in some region, the leading effects cancel, and then the next two leading can change things. And then the next to next start converging.
Yes, I think this is more the picture that I would have in mind, but I'm not an expert on that, yes.
So that would mean that there's another accident at the leading order.
Okay. So just to show what we've done is we've taken a supernova profile given by the
exactly.
What about 3 pion exchange?
No, but he said that something.
No, but it seems that the nuclear force is well described if you go to 2 pion exchange and.
Okay. What about the eta exchange or things like that? Huh? Like other measurement exchanges.
There is space. It seems like there is space for work.
There is space for work, I think. Yes. Okay. So the higher mesons will be suppressed more, the more massive mesons.
So the reason that the pion exchange is not suppressed is why?
Well, I think like there's symmetries structure of the same cell in the outer lives are different. When you have 2 pion exchange, we exchange 2 pseudoscale.
Okay, what does that mean? Because these are processes that.
Which is why, it is not much small, like even a neutron star.
But you're saying 3 is going to be a small correction to 1 because it's the same symmetry structure, but it's 2 big differences.
Even the odd ones would be different.
Can I ask that 3-level result you were showing on that slide? Is that the one that has the reduction that people would?
No, 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 that is really just the tree without the reduction. So both of them would get reduced similarly if one adds these factors.
So in what you're showing at the top, you're not using the two pion exchange is not.
No, but also not in the bottom. We are not taking.
So now you're comparing the tree level.
With the tree level plus.
Without the two pion.
Yes.
Is there a reason why they should scale together for the two? The two should scale together when you include the two pion exchange? Like, if you find now that the effect is more important, is there an expectation that the hierarchy between the tree level and the full result will remain as you find it? In the emission?
So, yeah, I think so. I mean, our effect, why this is so much bigger, is. Mostly, because of the change in the coupling to axions. So we think if you change the nuclear force, it would not affect that much our additional.
So it's a density-induced change in the coupling of the axions.
Exactly.
That's what gives.
And that is what we wanted to factorize from all the rest for now.
How much it is not easy
right.
to say.
So skeptical person would say, okay. Anywhere between upper curve and a lower curve, that's where you're through.
It's most likely higher because at zero density there's this accidental cancellation, and then finite density is most likely
most likely higher.
That's what they're finding.
Yes, so that is what we come to when we go to neutron stars, because there we are not confident to trust anything of our. Expansion anymore because the density goes higher. So our expectation is mainly that there is no reason for any cancellation to be there. Couplings change in when you go inside a nuclear star.
Just do naive dimensional analysis.
Exactly, just do naive dimensional analysis because there is no reason that the KSVZ axion should stay at zero. It will definitely go somewhere. And if you do naive dimensional analysis, you find that if that was your original expectation, that you are more at that expectation, where I'm plotting here now what I would call effective coupling inside a neutron star, even if that is a bit hand-wavy. But what we mean is that it's hard to put the neutron star bound on the plot where you differentiate between different models of the axion, because all couplings inside a neutron star, you don't really know them, but they will change order one within the neutron star, and that is our perspective that we got. Okay, so that brings me to the summary of my first part. So then I'll have about 15 minutes for the second, but that's okay. Before the summary, one more slide, Drew. So there are some models which try to avoid the axion-nucleon interaction. These are the so-called astrophobic axions, where you can somehow make the coupling small because of some cancellation in the UV, both to neutrons and protons. However, even the non-derivative coupling that is coming from the axion GG dual term, at subleading order gives rise then to these derivative couplings in our expansion. So we find that even though these theories avoid a leading order coupling, there is some coupling induced, as one would expect. And it leads to a slightly lower bound because it comes in subleading order, but you cannot get rid of that, and you cannot play this game for very long. That brings me to the conclusion on that. So couplings change with density. We have done a systematic calculation of the couplings itself within KPT. On the implications, we have not yet done a full systematic calculation, but it is something we want to do. The uncertainties become very large at high densities, so that at the end one can only do NDA. But any tuned couplings that are somehow small generically will change by order one, and one can not tune them small. And it might even be that this has some importance on terrestrial experiments. You might now wonder why, but one part of that why the axion coupling changes is because the axial nucleon coupling, this GA, changes a lot in dense objects, It's even known that this axial coupling gets quenched in nuclear beta decays here on Earth. So if you've tuned it smaller, even for the KZZ axion, where you have some prediction with if you set the GA to its real value, it will actually change a little bit depending on the nucleus that you are using. This might not seem important if you look at a parameter space that is a log-log and has orders of magnitude, but if at some point you have a measurement and you would want to maybe even go to a UV model, it might make a difference that you know and can correlate these things.
Probably people, when they take into account axion emissivity, they probably take this gamma speller quenching into account.
In the things that I've seen, not yet, but it might be. I'm not an expert in all of these experiments, but so far I've not seen it. But that's why there's only a question mark here. It's something that should at some point could become important, but in the end is not very important for now.
So you're saying that these are,
it's kind of the background.
2 minutes behind the discussion. So you're saying that the dense medium here is because in the terrestrial experiments you're using
a nuclei, a heavy nucleus.
Depending on the cancellation for the neutron, for depending on how many, which nucleus you're considering, this can be very, very.
This is a well-known fact.
It is a well-known fact, exactly.
Instead of 1.27 or whatever it is,
it's more 1.1.
Inside the nuclei. So the neutron
is
isolation and neutron inside the nucleus beta decay somewhat
so,
different.
But let me understand, is there an understanding of why it goes to one and not
there
two?
Is no lack of papers, but there is no uniform explanation.
Because one is what you would naively if the axial current was conserved, then you would get one, right? In a sense, naively.
Yes.
So, I see.
Okay. So then I would finish with that part and come in 10 minutes on the rest that I wanted to talk about. And it is how light pseudoscalars, so now we're going away from the real QCD axion, can change the structure of neutron stars. And I'm going to skip the introduction and just ask the question, how would neutron stars look like if neutrons would be lighter? And as a toy model, we're just looking at a free Fermi gas of neutrons. And if neutrons have a GeV, then, so this is here the mass, this is the radius, the neutron stars lie on this curve, which has a maximum mass of around 0.7 solar masses and this radius. Now, if you make them lighter by a factor of 2, the maximum mass goes up by a factor of 4. This is very easy to understand. So if you fix the energy density to have the same energy density, if you have a lighter mass, you need more nucleons. They have a Fermi pressure, so you have more pressure in the end. That means you can have larger and heavier things before they collapse. Now the question is, how can this be done with a scalar field? As a toy model, let's look at a periodic potential with some scalar lambda. So lambda sets the scale of the periodic potential. And we are adding a shift symmetry breaking coupling to nucleons. And we are assuming for now that it has the same shape of the, like the potential. And this coupling, of course, is a field-dependent mass of the nucleon. So the nucleon mass changes if the field value of phi changes. At the same time, this coupling here, in a background of nucleons, n bar n, gets an expectation value. And this modifies the potential of the scalar field. And so exactly this coupling is happening for the Valinda QCD axion with some small coupling. We are, however, going away from that and treat lambda and g as free parameters. So if n bar n in a dense medium gets an expectation value of order of number density, the potential can flip. So if the number density is bigger than that, the potential will flip. That means that the nucleons get lighter. And that can mean that the stars get heavier. So if the potential flips, then the out gets a non-trivial expectation value around dense objects. And it might happen for the vanilla QCD axion. There it's beyond any perturbative regime. So we are not looking at the vanilla QCD axion for now. We are looking at some axion-like particles or light-tuned.
So
this has to be like density over power is the vacuum term?
Sorry?
The density over power is the vacuum term. That's the speculation?
That would be the speculation here that...
How big is the density? It sounds like a lot.
No, exactly. Yeah, so that's why I say it might happen. We can also erase this comment. It's not clear if it happens.
How big does the density need to be compared to lambda?
So if you plug in now the numbers for the QCD axion where G is 0.025, you find that it would happen at a few times nuclear saturation density, where, of course, the estimate of taking only this term and nothing else is very wrong. I agree with that. They have done a more sophisticated analysis than what I'm describing now. And you can read...
So the speculation is the center of a neutron star will have like...
Could have axion equal pi.
Or 2 or something like this?
Pi.
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 But that is not what I'm... So I'm not really talking about the real QCD axion. I just want to tell you that it might happen.
Okay, sorry. So you're saying that the reason why this seems, sorry, I'm again, as usual, very, very behind everybody. So the reason why this seems hard is because for some reason we know that G is small.
Yeah, in the QCD axion, you can relate G to what is called the nuclear sigma term, because the axion comes in the quark masses, and then it depends on how much the quark masses contribute to the nuclear mass.
If I close my eyes, I know that the axion potential comes from QCD effects, which are even... they come from QCD effects, which are even suppressed by the pile mass. So it's not even lambda QCD, right? Because when one goes to zero. Yeah. So it's even less than the QCD energy density, the vacuum energy of the QCD. And if in the neutron star you have a density of matter that is of the order of the QCD scale, then isn't this reasonable that things may...
But the non-derivative coupling also just comes from the same effects. No?
Sorry, Dave?
This non-derivative coupling comes from, is suppressed by exactly the same pion mass effects.
Okay, fine. Okay. Then it's factored out. Very good.
It's factored out, yes.
This thing is factored out. So again, the only thing is whether the neutron star has a density that is sufficiently big, right?
Well, yes, but
that is hadronic density.
But
right?
At the sufficiently big densities, this is not the only operator you have to take into account. Now you have to take the next, and so on.
No, and
there is one with four nuclei.
I'm really saying that in a neutron star, the vacuum of QCD is differs by order one.
Yes.
So then the potential for the axion will differ by order one. Is this a fair statement?
I think that is. A first
therefore,
statement.
It's not unreasonable that the potential minimum flips from zero to pi or pi.
The nuclear saturation density is 0.15 times inverse Fermi cube or something like that. So you need to go to, which is like if you go to 6 saturation densities, then you get to the basically inverse 200. MeV numerator 200 MeV cube, and the QQ bar in the vacuum is roughly 250. Mm-hmm. So that's the rough scale. You have to go 5 or 6 nuclear densities, which is possible, but yeah, order one is correct.
Yeah, it's order one. I'm just saying
order
that.
One is correct, I'm but just saying to even naively flip it, you need to go like above 5 or 6.
Parametric is 5, 6.
Is 1.
I'm trying to understand. So yeah. The sense is not.
No, it's
crazy.
Not crazy, crazy. No.
Not that you are so.
But so yeah, I just want to take G and lambda for now as completely free parameters and not related to the QCD axion.
But if the axion goes to theta equals pi, inside the neutron star, there are several things that change, right? The pion mass changes.
The pion mass changes, the nuclear mass changes.
There's many things that change. So it's not just that potential.
No, no, but so what we are studying for now is a free Fermi gas where only the nuclear mass changes. We've also looked at a carrier perturbation theory equation of state where you have the pion in there and you can see how the pion mass changes because the axion goes to pi. So we have seen these things and we've seen that that is only a minor correction to the general picture that we have. The general picture that we you'll see in a bit is that these light scalars, if they would change the nucleon mass by a lot, could change really the, how neutron stars look like by a lot.
Let me ask you, at this new vacuum, what about the discrete symmetries? What about CP there? Do you still have an effective CP or is it broken because you're pi? So I'm trying to understand.
At pi, naively, it should still be
still
invariant.
Right.
Yes.
Still there. It just changes the pi. There's another.
It's just the definition of
the boundary where it goes from
pi to there. It will be exactly
zero there.
It will be violated because there is, of course, a finite
the
gradient.
Of the,
yes.
Of two phases, because it cannot be everywhere, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they are the complicated total equations that are gravity, scalar field, and fermion equation of state. We've solved them numerically, but there's a much more simplified limit, which we are talking now, namely if there's a small boundary, a thin wall, if the radius of the star is much bigger than the size that the scalar field typically takes, which is the inverse mass in vacuum or in density given by the density-dependent inverse mass. In that case, the field will stay at its minimum at pi and then transition very sharply outside of the star. And in that case, all gradient effects become small. And the opposite limit, the opposite hierarchy, is what happens that why the scalar field is not sitting at pi in a nucleus. Because in a nucleus, the gradient prevents it to go there. The radius of the nucleus needs to be small compared to.
If you change the sign of theta, it's like changing the sign of the quark masses. So isn't that the situation where now the neutron becomes heavier than the proton? Because there's an electron. So the...
I think it mostly changes the pion masses. It mostly changes the pion masses.
No, I understand it changes the pion mass, but the neutron-proton mass difference is coming from there's an electromagnetic effect that pushes up the proton, but then there's the quark mass that... But if you flip the sign of the quark contribution, then there are two contributions that push up the proton. Okay. That push down the proton, sorry. Yeah.
So now the neutron is roughly 10.
No, they all push up. No, it's stupid. They both push up.
No, but in this environment, still the Coulomb interaction.
Exactly, the big Coulomb thing would still make.
It's like in the nucleus, right? I mean, you don't have less protons than
heavy
nucleus.
Yes. Okay.
Okay, so if the axion just follows its potential, we can solve the axion equation of motion trivially and find it as a function of the number density, and then get this into the usual equation of states, where this is just the usual free Fermi gas, now with a field-dependent mass. And how this equation of state looks like. So what I'm showing here is the energy per particle, or energy density over number density, as a function of number density. So for a normal free Fermi gas, at zero number density, the energy per particle is just the mass. If you make the number density larger, there's contributions from the Fermi momentum. So of course, the energy per particle goes up. What this effect now does is that if it sits at theta equals zero to some given density, and then it wants to flip at this density to theta equal pi, it changes the nucleon mass, and therefore it lowers the energy per particle because the nucleon mass is smaller. So this can happen either up here, then something like this happens, but if the change in nucleon mass is very big compared to the potential, such that it happens at very low densities, then this flip happens already very quickly. And the energy per particle that you can have in this new vacuum can be smaller than the nucleon mass. What this means is that particles are bound together by the scalar field. They want to be in this phase where the scalar field is at pi, because they have less energy per particle than the normal nucleon mass. So they're self-bound and some, we call it a new ground state of matter. So the mass radius curve, this is now just for one specific value of the coupling and the scale that is in the potential. So the free Fermi gas has this line that goes up to 0.7 Nish solar masses. With the scalar, you're first having a metastable branch where the scalar is not, so the density is below critical. So it is metastable because the energy per particle in the other branch is smaller. But it cannot go there because you need a density fluctuation big enough such that you access the stable branch. And then there's this new ground state branch, which is a stable branch, which can change the radius and mass by order a few. So
how does that change when you take into account temperature?
When you take into account temperature, so everything changes a bit and nothing changes drastically.
Because I'm thinking, if you have such a large coupling that you are bound by the force, what happens, the cosmology of these guys would be completely different. You'd be forming like weird...
weird nuggets of these things that could even be dark matter. We have...
I don't know what they are.
Yes.
You would change BBN by a lot, it looks like.
The density is much bigger than temperature at BBM, so if you never reheat above too high temperatures, you don't change the cosmology too much.
No, but I'm talking about earlier. Even before BBM, you have neutrons and protons, why don't you form, and they are relativistic, why don't you form bound states then?
Because the density is smaller than the nuclear density.
No, that's true. It's not very positive.
Yes. So let me maybe finish with that plot.
Why don't you form bound state?
Neutrons are super dense.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if there is a bound state you can form, I'm just a bit confused about when do you transition. It's a very dumb question.
Right.
You have very high densities, right? When does a nucleus in this case, I mean, you assume that the mass of the axion is, what are you assuming here for the mass of the axion? You're assuming it's large enough so that for a nucleus it doesn't matter?
For a nucleus it doesn't matter because of the gradient in the axion. So the axion field needs to go all the way to pi f, and this huge gradient makes it, so you need a big object at the same time as you need a dense object.
Yes.
Exactly. So the last slide that I wanted to show is just basically the same now for different benchmark points, where you, in black, you have the free Fermi gas line, and then I have here a hypothetical QCD axion line, assuming that the QCD axion would flip. It would look somehow similar like that, but you can take
which
that really.
One is it? Because
the red.
Away some of the colors look similar.
So that one is this one, which goes to here then.
Okay.
So it has it follows the mid this branch, and then there's a phase transition, and then it goes to here. And then there are these light QCD axions where the mass is tuned away. They, depending on how much you tune the mass away, go first out and then come back in. And make, since the change of the nucleon mass is not so big, they make them only a little bit heavier. And then there are models where we make the couplings to quarks as strong as we want to, and then you see that you can really change the structure by order a few. Okay, and I think I'm out of time, so then I'll leave it there.
Constraints on this from like the neutron star merger we have observed, because there were some constraints in the equation of state from that.
Yeah, so there are constraints. So this is a pulsar that has been observed that has a mass above two solar masses. These constraints, I don't remember if they were nicer. I don't think they were from from the binary inspiral that we have observed, but from other measurements, but I don't remember which ones. It's been a while.
What are the gray regions?
So in that region up here, it would be a black hole. Similar things on causality constraints, so different theoretical constraints that we have. So they are not observational constraints, but we know that neutron stars should not live up there.
This is a causality constraint based on what?
I think in the end it is based on Buchdahl's limit. I forgot the details, let me think. Yeah, I think you're assuming the stiffest equation of state that is okay with a... Huh? Yeah, so it's an equation of state statement, yes. So the stiffest that is okay with causality.
Subluminality.
Exactly, subluminality, yes.
Other questions? Right, okay, there is a question from Zoom.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment about the axion production from finite density matter. And the comment relates to whether all estimates of axion production are model dependent or rely on chiral perturbation theory. It turns out that there is a, if you're at low enough densities, there's a low energy theorem which is constant, which is often used to describe soft Bremsstrahl law from colliding particles, and this is used, you know, very often in the terrestrial context. And you can use that to obtain a model-independent estimate of the axion emission at low density, because you can relate the axion emissivity to the on-shell scattering amplitude, which is actually measured. So there is a benchmark. There's a benchmark calculation of what the axion rate should be in the low density leading density limit.
So it's just a factorized, just some soft factorization.
Right. Exactly. If you do, if the axion energy is very small compared to the nucleon kinetic energy, then you can factorize and show that the amplitude that matters is only the on-shell amplitude, which is a measured phase shift. Yeah, if you're, I mean, so if you're interested in it, I'm happy to correspond with you.
Yes, please.
Thanks.
Thanks, yeah.
There's another stupid question. So, like, there's like a GA gamma-gamma, like that change something of story.
Of which story? Of the first story or the second? So of this story here, I'm actually right now investigating with Andrea Caputo and Sam Witte how a GA gamma-gamma would or could change the emission of pulsars, the radio emission of pulsars, because they have a halo of the scalar field around. And if this pseudoscalar were coupled to FF dual, this would induce a charge density locally outside or act like a charge density. So there should be effects. Some people have investigated some effects. I think the ones we are looking at has not been done, but we are at the beginning of the investigation.
But the light cylinder is quite far.
Sorry?
The light cylinder is quite far.
The light cylinder is quite far.
For the neutrons.
Yes.
For the supernova cooling, this is not going to be important because photons are far less numerous in some sense.
I was thinking about
them, the nucleons.
Neutron star magnetic field. Yeah. Okay, thanks. So
the expectation for pulsars is what?
Well, it's just like the radio emission, they are usually coming from the light cylinder, which is quite far from the cluster surface.
Yes, but at least that is what I've been told now by Sam and Andrea a couple of times. is that the radio emission depends crucially on pair production of electrons very close to the surface. Exactly. You can. That is what we are investigating. We can discuss offline afterwards if you want to. We'll be very interested to hear your opinion.
Okay, if there are no more questions, we can thank the speaker.